From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a long simmering debate in the Catholic Church comes to a close as a liberal archbishop is beatified in El Salvador. We'll explain.
But first, California's ongoing drought is pushing a group of farmers to consider something they've never done before. They're offering the state a deal. They'll give up 25% of their water now if regulators promise not to hit them with even more draconian cuts later this year. Of course, everyone in the state has been looking at ways to use less water this year, but this particular group of growers is special. Dan Brecky has been following this for Here and Now contributor KQED in San Francisco and joins us now. Hi there, Dan.
Hey there.
So first of all, these farmers are part of a coalition of growers in the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta. They've got actually some of the strongest claims to water in the state. So why are they considering giving up or offering a cut now?
Well, one of the people involved in this said this is a way of taking a haircut now to avoid a beheading later. And what they mean by that is if they give up, and they're talking about giving up 25% of their water now, the hope is that they will be able to avoid a complete curtailment, the technical term for a cutoff, later in this year. And that would be a disaster, obviously, for somebody who depends on water to grow crops.
Right. And just goes to show how bad the drought is there, because these growers have claims to water that go back more than a century. They're amongst the oldest in the state. And when water is scarce, cuts are based on seniority. So even this group is facing potentially draconian cuts later this year.
Well, the situation really is dire, and people are looking around for solutions. You're right that this group, if there are ironclad, completely locked-in water rights anywhere in the state, this group has them. They're next to the rivers that they take the water from. That's called riparian water rights, and they were established before 1914, and that's the oldest class. So, you know, in a normal year, that means they can take whatever they want, essentially. I mean, that's not technically true, but that's what the practical reality. But now people are scared. And this, and the interesting thing about this deal is that now the state is looking at whether it could be extended beyond the Delta, which is a relatively small, although a very important pocket of agriculture, into other watersheds as well.
Right. And just for some context, I'm seeing that this group has only had their share of water cut once in 100 years in the past century. So what are state water regulators saying in response to the offer?
Well, they said they're interested. This was the subject of a public discussion a couple of days ago. And I think people are looking at this. The State Water Resources Control Board, which handles all these water rights, says that it looks like a creative solution. And they've actually said later today they are going to have an announcement on which direction they'll go. I think everybody expects them to say, yes, we like this idea. And now let's study how far we can extend it.
Mm. Now, Dan, what could this mean for agricultural production overall? I mean, California grows so much of the nation's food. If this deal is approved and then potentially expanded, you know, what impact could it have on supermarkets across the country?
You know, that's always a little hard to say. Prices, you know, their production was cut back a lot last year. There were about 400,000 or 500,000 acres that were fallowed. They just sat idle. And that's about half the size of Rhode Island. I don't know if that seems vast back there, but out here that seems vast. Prices didn't go up a lot because of that, but there's no doubt that production will be seriously impacted this year, whatever is being grown.
Well, Dan Brecky is a reporter and editor at KQED in San Francisco, talking to us about growers offering to cut their own water use in California by 25%. Dan, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, tomorrow in El Salvador, a debate that has roiled the Catholic Church for decades will come to a close. Oscar Romero, the late Archbishop of San Salvador, will be beatified. That's the final step before sainthood. Joining us from San Salvador is John Allen, Associate Editor for the Boston Globe and for Crux, which covers the Catholic Church for the Globe. John, thanks for being here.
It is a pleasure to be with you.
Well, and remind us, first of all, about Oscar Romero for people who aren't familiar with him.
Well, Oscar Romero was early in his career a fairly conventionally conservative, traditional, button-down Salvadoran cleric. In 1977, somewhat unexpectedly, he was named the Archbishop of San Salvador, which made him, in effect, the leader of the National Church. Shortly after that, one of his closest friends, a Jesuit priest by the name of Rutilio Grande, was shot to death for standing up to the country's, what was then basically its oligarchic power structure. That loss, by all accounts, in some ways radicalized Romero, and he emerged very quickly as the most important spokesperson in El Salvador in favor of human rights, against abuses of authority, and in favor of justice for the poor, at a time, of course, when El Salvador was on the cusp of what would turn out to be a bloody 12-year civil war. And for those positions that threatened the powers that be, Romero was shot to death while saying mass on March 24th, 1980, an assassination for which no one in the 35 years since has ever officially been charged, although a 1993 United Nations investigation concluded that it was engineered by a right-wing El Salvadoran politician with links to the military named Roberto Dabasan. So Romero would, in effect, be the most important, the most iconic, if you like, contemporary martyr of the Catholic Church.
And by the way, the military regime, the right-wing regime in El Salvador that Romero was speaking out against and was opposed to was backed by the United States.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, ironically, one of his last acts before being shot to death was to write then U.S. President Jimmy Carter to ask him to stop funding the right-wing military regime in El Salvador, arguing that all they know how to do is oppress and abuse their own people. That legacy of U.S. involvement in Central America, and specifically in El Salvador, is very much tied up with the story of Oscar Romero.
But for decades, the Catholic Church has not wanted to call Romero a martyr, saying that his assassination didn't meet the traditional test for martyrdom.
That's true, although, you know, by conventional standards, sainthood causes often take centuries to unfold. So reaching the penultimate step within 35 years, historically speaking, is fairly rapid. But it is fair to say that Romero's sainthood cause from the moment he died became a lightning rod and a point of division in the Catholic Church. One of the issues was whether he had been killed for religious reasons or political motives, which has to do with the traditional test for martyrdom in the Catholic Church, that you have to be killed in odium fidei, meaning in hatred of the faith. Some conservative Latin American cardinals felt that if a halo were to be awarded to Oscar Romero, it would be misunderstood as an endorsement of radical leftist Marxist politics and guerrilla warfare. Others worried that it would be seen as a blessing for liberation theology, which was and still is a movement within the Catholic Church that began in Latin America, seeking to place the church on the side of the poor. And its critics saw it as an effort to sort of baptized Marxist insurrection. On the other hand, I also think that Saturday's beatification, to some extent, marks a definitive end to the controversy over Oscar Romero.
And the move to get to Saturday's beatification began with Pope Benedict and then, of course, continued now with the support of Pope Francis.
That's right. I mean, it's worth remembering that Pope Benedict, when he was still a cardinal, as Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, had been the Vatican official, but to some extent waged some fairly titanic battles with the liberation theology movement. But in the course of all that, he also developed a real appreciation for Archbishop Romero. And so as Pope, he removed what had been a kind of informal block that was placed on the canonization process prior to that point. And then, of course, with the election of Francis in March 2013, the first Latin American pope in history, I think, felt a special personal and biographical desire to be the one who would carry Oscar Romero across the finish line.
Do you see this as part of a larger just move to the left, a dramatic move to the left by the Catholic Church under this pope?
No, I think what the beatification of Romero signifies instead is that the old left-right battles over liberation theology are basically over, and what has taken hold is a moderate consensus which goes like this. If Oscar Romero and liberation theology, if what that means is putting the church on the side of the poor and on the side of justice, then the official answer to that is yes. Now, if liberation theology means Marxism, and it means armed insurrection, and it means class warfare, then the answer is no. I think that is the centrist consensus in Catholicism after the dust settled from the 80s and 90s. I think it was waiting for a centrist pope to sort of lift it up and make it official policy, and that is, in effect, what is happening under Pope Francis.
John Allen, associate editor at the Boston Globe and at Crux, which is the Globe site that's devoted to covering the Catholic Church. John, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And stay with us much more ahead as we get into this holiday weekend edition of Here and Now, Here and Now. The State Department is releasing its first batch of emails that Hillary Clinton wrote as Secretary of State using a private email address. And the Associated Press is reporting today that Clinton did receive information about the deadly 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, on her private email server. They weren't classified before. Now they are.
So that's just some of the 2016 news that's making headlines this week. And Jeremy, I know you love this part. So
here we go.
Cue the song.
Here and now,
2016.
Joining us now, Julie Mason, host of the Press Pool on SiriusXM's POTUS Channel 124. Hi, Julie.
Hey.
And Don Gagne is with us, national political correspondent for NPR. He's been in Iowa with the Republican candidates over the past week. Hi, Don.
And I keep my little pitch pipe in my bag so I can always sing at a moment's notice
Good.
On the trail.
It's always nice to bring a little barbershop quartet to the 2016 race. Well, Julie, let me start with you. Hillary Clinton, she took questions from reporters on Tuesday for the first time in nearly a month. She said she wanted the State Department to release these emails as soon as possible. Let's listen to what she said on Tuesday.
I have said publicly, I'm repeating it here in front of all of you today, I want them out as soon as they can get out.
But will you demand it? Will you demand it?
Well, they're not mine. They belong to the State Department. So the State Department has to go through its process, but as much as they can expedite that process, that's what I'm asking them to do. Please move as quickly as they possibly can.
So they have done that. And what do you make, Julie, of the news that has come out so far about these emails?
Well, the emails, part of the problem with the emails is that she destroyed a whole bunch of them, so we will never actually know. There's new headlines today that some, as you just reported, that some of those emails are now being classified. But if she really wanted to get them out so fast, why did she keep them on a private server? It just strains credulity. She's doing herself no favors with this whole issue.
Don, your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll tell you, we don't know how big of an issue this is in the grand scheme of things between now and not this, but next November. But I can tell you where it is a very big issue. It's on the Republican side. And I was in Iowa chasing these candidates around. 11 of them spoke at a big Lincoln Day dinner over the weekend in Des Moines. And a very common a meme that has developed is counting up the number of days it's been since Hillary has answered a question, and then tallying up the number of questions that each of these candidates has been asked. I've been asked hundreds of questions, they say. She has taken 11, or maybe now they'll have to up it, to like 18 or 20 or something like that. But it is a huge, huge issue on that side. Again, giving them all a common foil and allowing them to seem more open, more transparent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Don, while
true enough, but Don, I'm sorry. What about Scott Walker? He hasn't taken questions in weeks.
That's true. That's true. He was not at the thing this weekend, so I didn't
standing
hear it
down,
from him.
Sir.
But it is an issue that they're talking about, which is not to say that they are all open and accessible and ready to answer every question we want to put with them. Far be it.
Yeah. So. Well, Don, I mean, while we're talking about Iowa, let's talk about where the voters' minds are there. We have some tape of someone you spoke with, voter Sherry Coyer. She's in
Quaker.
Yep. My apologies, Sherry, if you're listening. She's a voter in Sioux County, and she was at a Rick Perry event, and she gave you her assessment of the former Texas governor.
I liked him. I listened to Bobby Jindal yesterday. I liked him. And I liked Ben Carson. I met him in Des Moines. So that's the problem. It's just very difficult. I want to stay open to the best person.
Don, was there anyone Sherry didn't like?
I'm trying to think. I talked to so many people that day. But here's what I heard generally. This was in northwestern Iowa, far northwestern Iowa, which is the most conservative part of the state, and you do have a heavy evangelical component there. I would find people who were more likely to hedge their bets about Jeb Bush or Chris Christie and some of the candidates that they perceive as being moderate. But there are a lot of candidates who Christian conservative voters find very likable in this in this big and growing Republican field, and that's part of the very interesting dynamic. 4 years ago, Rick Santorum won the Iowa caucuses, though it took him a few weeks to figure that out because it was so close. Before that, it was Mike Huckabee winning the Iowa caucuses. They both kind of had a clear lane with those Christian conservative voters, those evangelical voters. This year, it's going to be fragmented because, as you heard her saying, there are just so many candidates that they like, which could really fragment that part of the caucus vote.
And one of the big issues on the Republican side this week has been the question of whether these candidates would have invaded Iraq, given what we know now. I want to listen to some tape here from some of the leading candidates, Julie, and then come to you. Jeb Bush here, who has had difficulty answering this question. He was asked about it at a business roundtable lunch in New Hampshire on Wednesday.
The focus ought to be on knowing what you know now, Mr. President. Should you have kept 10,000 troops in Iraq, or 15,000, or 4,000? That's the better answer, because of yesterday, Ramadi has now been taken over by ISIS. ISIS didn't exist when my brother was president.
So putting the onus on President Obama there. Marco Rubio was on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace. He was asked about it, too.
Was it a mistake?
A mistake for the president to decide to go into Iraq, because at the time he was
I'm not asking you that. I'm asking you
in hindsight. Yes. Well, the world is a better place because Saddam Hussein is not there.
So was it
I
a
wouldn't
mistake
characterize
or not?
It. But I don't understand the question you're asking.
I'm asking you, knowing everything, as we sit here in 20.
Okay, so that went on for a while. And then here's Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker talking on Face the Nation.
I think any president, regardless of party, probably would have made a similar decision to what President Bush did at the time with the information he had available. Remember, even Secretary of State, then Senator Clinton, voted for measures supporting the Iraq war. I think it was a failure in many cases in the intelligence that was given to the president, to the Congress at the time.
Julie, what is the right answer for a Republican? Or did any of these guys do well in their answer given what they want to achieve right now?
I don't know that there is a good answer to that question. It's such a trap for Republicans, isn't it? Because either you challenge the Republican orthodoxy by challenging Bush and saying, no, I wouldn't have gone into Iraq. And then there's all sorts of risks attendant with that, too. But then so you're not hawkish enough. It's a hypothetical with no good answer. And there they go. You hear Marco Rubio trying to be nuanced in the presidential campaign, which is an atmosphere that rejects nuance of any kind at all. And so you just get caught up in these traps. And it's terrible. Hypotheticals are awful. And a much better question is, what would you do now about ISIS? But I do think we're going to get really bogged down in this campaign about who was to blame for the creation of ISIS. And it seems to me that both presidents share a bit of the blame. But we're going to hear from Republicans that this was all President Obama's fault.
And what they're trying to do is get past that question. Maybe they say it was a mistake. Rick Perry certainly says, knowing what we know now, it was a mistake. But they say that the goal was honorable, and then they make the pivot to put it on President Obama. And Senator Lindsey Graham, who is about to get into the race in the next couple of days, said in Iowa this week, everybody's trying to put the blame on George W. Bush about the current state of things in Iraq. The blame goes squarely on the shoulders of Barack Obama, period.
Well, let's talk.
I'm sorry to
jump in there, but there is another sort of really big issue that's perplexing both Democrats and Republicans that I do want to talk about, and that is that bulk collection of phone records by the NSA, because on the Senate floor on Wednesday, Rand Paul talked for 10 and a half hours against a House-approved bill that would end the NSA's surveillance of American phone records. He says he wants even more reform, so let's listen.
Whether or not we should collect all Americans' phone records all the time should be discussed in public. It should have been revealed in an honest way. The fact that the director of our national intelligence lied to us and said the program didn't even exist, I think is unforgivable.
So, Julie, is this one issue in which Rand Paul can really differentiate himself, a winning issue for him?
Yeah, well, he certainly does. So far, the only other member of the Republican field who agrees with him, oddly enough, is Mike Huckabee. And what a strange pairing that is. You know, when Rand Paul started on this crusade against the NSA's surveillance program, he was on the side of public opinion, and it really looked like a winner for him. He looked like sort of a righteous warrior in this crusade. But now, with the rise of ISIS and concerns about terrorism, especially among Republicans, it doesn't look like such a winning issue. But where it could actually help him is with younger voters. He's making a strong play for them, and this is an area they're very concerned about.
All right, one more thing real quick, Don. Republican National Committee announcing rules for the first candidates debate on August 6th. I can't believe we're getting to the point where it's almost debate season here, but Cleveland, Ohio. And they're only going to allow the top 10 finishers in the national polls, an average of the national polls, into the debate, which would leave out, at this moment anyway, Governor Bobby Jindal, Carly Fiorina. What do you think of that?
You know, 10 is still a lot of people. I mean, it was hard to imagine
Come on.
How unwieldy it was going to be with 18 or 19. So I think there is a sense that they have to do something, but people are going to be mad. And then there's the later debate. It's a CNN debate at the Reagan Library in September, where they're going to have a two-part debate. One part will have 10 based on polls, and then the other part will open it up to anybody who's over 1%. I mean, imagine you'll stand on the stage for an hour and a half, and by the time you divvy up the time, you might get one or two sentences out of your mouth.
It's going to look like
democracy.
It's going to look like an airport where you have all the ticket counters. You could do it in the airport, actually. Don Gagne from NPR, national political correspondent, and Julie Mason, host of the Press Pool on SiriusXM's POTUS Channel 124. Thanks so much, as always, guys.
Thank you.
It won't be dull.
Walmart, the country's largest food retailer, is calling on its U.S. suppliers to treat farm animals better and raise them with fewer antibiotics. In a statement on its website, Walmart says it believes the animals in its supply chain should be treated humanely throughout their lives. But the guidelines are voluntary, and they come amid pressure over apparent mistreatment of pigs at farms that supply Walmart. Michael Regan of Bloomberg News has more and joins us now. Hi there, Mike.
Hi.
So first of all, Walmart has thousands of suppliers in the U.S. So what exactly is Walmart calling on them to do?
Well, they want their meat, dairy, and egg suppliers basically to use antibiotics more responsibly. In other words, only use them if animals are actually sick and need to take them, and have a veterinarian on site to oversee their use. And they want more transparency about how the antibiotics are used. They want the suppliers to report, you know, about how often they're being used and what they're being used for. And they're also, they want them to follow what is known as the Five Freedoms, which comes from a group called the Farm Animal Welfare Council. And the freedoms are things like freedom from hunger and thirst, freedom from discomfort, freedom from pain, injury, disease, freedom to express normal farm animal behavior, and freedom from fear and distress. Mm. So, you know, basically treat animals more humanely than many suppliers do.
Right. And what's the business decision behind what Walmart is doing here? Why do they think it's important to do this now?
Well, concerns have really grown recently that the misuse of antibiotics can cause resistance to them, which would basically make not only animals but humans more susceptible to getting sick, even if they take antibiotics. And there's really been a trend towards greater awareness of the food supply chain. Obviously, Chipotle has had a lot of success. And in part of it is their marketing that the meat they buy is from farms that treat animals more humanely. And in the grocery business, obviously, Whole Foods has been a big success story, too. So there clearly is, you know, building consumer demand for more, you know, humane treatment of animals and more natural, you know, less antibiotics and less hormones in the food chain.
I'm seeing a report here that Walmart's own research shows that 66% of its shoppers said they would increase their likelihood to shop at a place that does improve the treatment of livestock. But I also note that Walmart doesn't have any sort of deadline on when it would want its suppliers to move to this new practice.
right? It's not something that they could really do overnight. Some companies have already moving in this direction, including Tyson Foods, which is one of the biggest chicken suppliers in the country. And Tyson CEO Don Smith said this month that they're trying to eliminate the use of human-used antibiotics in their chicken production, and it'll take until about September of 2017, so more than 2 years to do that. Interestingly, he said they should be able to do it without having a major impact on their costs or profit margins. But that said, it's still obviously a slow process to pull this off.
Right. And in just a couple seconds, Mike, could this have an effect on the rest of the grocery and retail industry?
Yeah, absolutely, especially because Walmart has such influence over its suppliers. You know, the general trend is that if Walmart says jump, the suppliers say how high and when is the next flight to Arkansas. So it certainly could have ripple effects throughout the industry.
Michael Regan is with Bloomberg News. Thanks, as always, for speaking with us, Mike.
Thank you.
The self-declared Islamic State, or ISIS, continues to gain ground in Iraq and Syria. The extremists have now seized the last Syrian-controlled border crossing between Syria and Iraq. Seth Jones is director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. He's with us now from Washington. Seth, thanks for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be on.
Well, and this has been a very bad week in the fight against ISIS when you look at the fact that they've taken Ramadi, they've taken Palmyra in Syria, this ancient town, and now this border crossing.
Yeah, what we're seeing is ISIS really beginning to not just secure areas that they now control, but also to expand in parts of Iraq, expand in parts of Syria. And what's really disturbing is that over the last couple of months, the United States has tried to double down by putting intelligence personnel, special operations forces, and then air power into the fight, and clearly have not been sufficient to keep ISIS back from expanding.
Well, should the U.S. be doing more then? Should the U.S. be providing more air support, more guidance on the ground to fight back?
I think, as in any war right now, that the U.S.'s role has got to be both political and military. It's not just and should not be a military effort. The political is, frankly, just as if not more important. And I think that what that means is, at the national level, trying to continue to address Sunni grievances with what is, at least among Sunnis, perceived to be a Shia Iranian-backed government. And the same is true in key places of Iraq, including Anbar province. On the military side, that does mean reaching out to some of those aggrieved individuals. And I think, as we saw with the awakening in 2006, 7, and 8, the most successful kinds of U.S. assistance are likely to be clandestine ones with some air power. But the United States cannot really provide any major ground operation. It's likely to undermine any legitimacy of the Iraqi government or elsewhere. And it's going to walk right into a propaganda campaign from ISIS. I think we just got to settle in. This is going to be a long-term effort. I think the U.S. needs to get very serious about this. ISIS is expanding in Iraq and Syria. It's expanding in Libya. It's now expanding in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's not going away.
Well, and then the question becomes, does the U.S. need to be fearful of getting too involved in something like this and getting dragged in? And obviously, there is a big fear in this country that the U.S. is going to be dragged right back in to another long ground war.
Well, look, the United States already is involved in this war. And frankly, I think based on what ISIS has said, including in its most recent issue of Dabiq magazine, where it talks about the potential for bringing a nuclear weapon into the United States after securing it in Pakistan, this organization does present a threat to the region. It presents a threat more broadly to the international system, and it definitely presents a threat to the United States. Where I think the U.S. has to be careful is in the strategy it uses. And I think, as we've seen in both Afghanistan and Iraq after the U.S. invasion, large numbers of American ground forces will not do it. I think the U.S. is going to have to rely on the local Iraqi government in Iraq, as well as in local allies, Kurds, Sunnis in Anbar province. And then it's got to find a better strategy in Syria. Syria, in my view, is really the big vulnerability to U.S. strategy right now.
Well, do you agree then with House Speaker John Boehner, who said this week that President Obama needs to go back to the Congress with a new authorization that asks for even more power than he has now to fight ISIS?
I'm not sure the U.S. needs a lot more power in Iraq and Syria. I think the biggest vulnerability is convincing a range of the Sunnis to support the Iraqi government and the West in targeting ISIS. Putting more U.S. ground resources into Iraq will not solve the problem.
But can anyone win this without the U.S.?
I think what the U.S. provides is an ability to influence the Iraqi government that really nobody else, except for possibly Iran, has. And I think the U.S. is a good counter to Iranian power and influence in Baghdad. And the second is the U.S. can provide really the world's best military technology, precision-guided munitions, some of the most competent intelligence collection units. So I don't think the Iraqi government is going to be able to do this without U.S. support.
That's Seth Jones, the director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. Seth Jones, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was great to be on.
Los Angeles, $15. Seattle, $15. Chicago, $13. Louisville, $9. Those are just a few of the cities that have raised the minimum wage. In Oregon, lawmakers are mulling a bill to raise the state's minimum wage to $12 an hour, and a bill has already been filed to raise the minimum for adults in Oregon with developmental disabilities. Many are paid less than the minimum wage, and they're paid with taxpayer dollars. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Chris Lehman reports.
It's a Wednesday morning at the Water Reclamation Facility in McMinnville, Oregon. The sprawling campus is tucked away in a suburban industrial park. Two vans pull up, marked All Seasons Grounds Care. Soon the air is filled with the sounds of yard maintenance. And soon after that, some of the curious workers come over to say hi to the reporter.
My name's Deborah Wood. Nice to meet you.
Like her colleagues, Deborah Wood has intellectual disabilities. And like all of the All Seasons employees I spoke with, she loves her job.
We mow and blow and pull weeds and rake leaves and do litter control. And I pick up the pruning and they use a weed eater.
And like many of the others on the grounds crew, Wood gets paid less than minimum wage. All Seasons Grounds Care is run by Salem-based Shangri-La Corporation. It's a nonprofit that helps people with disabilities develop job skills and find housing. Shangri-La's Employment Services Director, Terry Marsh, says the goal is for grounds crew employees to gain enough work experience that they can go on to another job with better pay.
It happens fairly frequently.
But while they're at Shangri-La, many of the grounds crew members work for less than $6 per hour, well below the Oregon minimum wage of $9.25. That's allowed by an exception to both federal and state minimum wage law. Marsh says it allows lower pay for disabled workers who can't perform at 100% productivity levels as judged by industry standards.
For our crew here, the average productivity, I think, is around 40-45%. So we have some people who make minimum wage, and we have some people who make less.
There are about 500 workers in Oregon who are paid sub-minimum wage through contracts from state and local agencies. Some make safety vests for the State Department of Transportation. Others shred paper or sort mail. But Democratic State Senator Sarah Gelser says no one should be paid under the minimum wage, especially when taxpayers are footing the bill.
We're having a conversation about raising the minimum wage and talking about how fair wages are important to everyone. People with disabilities are Oregonians too, and we absolutely can't leave them behind.
Gelser has filed a bill that would require nonprofits that use disabled workers under government contracts to pay those workers at least minimum wage. But Gelser realizes that places like Shangri-La might not be able to foot the bill, so her measure would require government agencies that pay for the contracts to subsidize the higher wage.
So it really is the legislature or the public body that is taking on that increased cost. We're not asking the nonprofits to go out and raise a bunch of extra money.
Gelser says there's no reason why any disabled worker would lose their job as a result of the measure. But Terry Marsh of Shangri-La isn't convinced.
While I believe that our public agencies believe in employment for all people, everybody's fighting for money right now.
And Marsh says it's ultimately a trade-off. The lower wage allows Shangri-La to take on more workers. There's about 24 on the job here in McMinnville. But the less than minimum wage also means less money in the pockets of people like David Kent. He's been working for All Seasons Grounds Care for almost 8 years, and he watches every penny.
To save up for me and my spouse to do something together.
He wants to take his wife on vacation.
Probably to coast for a day or something.
But it could be a few years before Kent sees a bigger paycheck, even if the measure to up the minimum wage for people with disabilities does pass. That's because existing contracts would be grandfathered in under Oregon's current law. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Lehman.
Memorial Day weekend is upon us, which for many people means the first real beach weekend of the year. Just in time, there is a new list of the top 10 public beaches in the country, at least according to a man with the nickname Dr. Beach. His real name is Stephen Leatherman. He's a professor in the Department of Earth and Environment at Florida International University. He's been putting together this list of the top 10 beaches for years, and he's with us from Miami to tell us about this year's winners. Stephen, welcome.
My pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's go through the winners from this year. And we've got a couple from Hawaii. There are four beaches in Florida. Then there's Cape Hatteras in the Outer Banks of North Carolina, Coast Guard Beach on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, a beach in Kiawah Island in South Carolina, and then a beach in Santa Barbara in California, which is right now dealing with an oil spill, although not this beach, right?
That's right. It's farther north. It's one of the parks there. This beach, East Beach, is really the little village beach, and there's actually a mountain that sort of divides this area to the north of Santa Barbara. So I don't see any way that oil's going to get down there. But it's really, you know, really unfortunate we see this. In fact, people ask me, aren't beaches always the same? And I said, well, no. About any beach, you can have a bad day. You can have storms come and erode the sand away, oil spills. So I've seen sewer lines break. I mean, you wouldn't believe the things that can happen. Hmm. But fortunately, East Beach is not, Santa Barbara isn't experiencing any of those things.
And I noticed that my favorite beach, or at least one of my favorite beaches, Lanikai Beach in Hawaii, did not make your list this year, but that's because it has won in past years, and you retire beaches that have won in the past. By the way, we should say the number one beach on your list, Waimanalo Bay Beach Park in Oahu, Hawaii, is very close to Lanikai. But tell us about how you retire the past beaches.
Well, if I didn't retire them, then those beaches would probably win again. I mean, there's... In the United States, we are blessed with hundreds of wonderful beaches. In fact, people say, why isn't my beach on the top 10 list? I said, do you know how difficult it is to get on the top 10 list when we got hundreds and hundreds of great beaches? So the thing is, the idea is that the number one beach gets the most media, probably gets 90% of the attention. So the idea is retire that one and give all the other beaches a chance to be in the limelight.
How do you decide on this? How do you pick the best beaches?
Well, I use 50 criteria. First of all, you got to have clean sand, clean water. People, you absolutely have to have that or you have no chance. And then after that, beach safety is really important. I don't mean, you know, pickpockets or things like that. That's in there too. But largely, rip currents are the biggest danger at surf beaches. So, and unfortunately, a lot of drowning. So I really emphasize safety. You have to have that. If lifeguards are there, a lot of extra points for that. And also environmental management. How's the area managed? Of course, people want clear water. Clear water doesn't mean that it's clean, but usually it is. And people like to see their toes, I guess. But altogether, 50 criteria go into rating beaches and, of course, beach access. One of the worst things is you pack up the kids, you get to a park, and it's closed because it's jammed with people. Also, people want some creature comforts. I mean, there's some beaches in Shishi Beach, for instance, Olympic National Park, but it's an 8-mile walk into this area, so a lot of people aren't willing to do that or can't do that.
I see that you give beaches extra credit when they ban smoking.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most disgusting things I find is to go to a beach, because to me, when I go to the beach, it's like commuting with nature. If I sit down on the beach and put my hands down, and there's a cigarette butt there, I'm just really disgusted. And these filters don't degrade very fast. In fact, I see kids biting on them. I go, oh my gosh, not to mention animals eating them. So cigarette butts are the number one form of litter on beaches. I mean, not in terms of quantity. That's, of course, plastics. But I don't see any reason why people should use our beaches as giant ashtrays and think that that's all right. So I think it's an easy thing to do, and there's some beaches that have done it, and all the beaches in Oahu now are non-smoking. There's a few in the continental United States, and I'd like to promote more beaches to be non-smoking, not only for people's health, but also for the quality of the environment.
What state that has beaches never wins?
Well, one of the most beautiful beaches I've seen is the state of Oregon. You drive the coastal highway, Highway 101, And it's just phenomenal. A lot of great beach camping for a song. I mean, $5 to go camping. But really, the water is too cold and the currents are too dangerous. And keep in mind, my survey is for swimming beaches. So if the water is 50, 60 degrees or 50s, you just can't swim in that water. At least most people can't. And also, Oregon and state of Washington, Maine, all those beaches will never be in the list because you get some dangerous currents and big waves. So that doesn't work for swimming beaches.
Now, you're going to clear the slate next year. So all the past winners will be able to be eligible again to be at the top of your list of the best beaches. What do you think? What's your favorite beach right now?
Well, I guess my favorite beach would be Kapalua Bay Beach in Maui, Hawaii, but it's hard to get there. You know, I can't get to Hawaii, but every so often. But I guess my favorite beach, which is close nearby, would be Cape Florida, because I can get there in about 30 minutes.
That's Stephen Leatherman, who's a professor in the Department of Earth and Environment at Florida International University. We'll link you to his list of the best beaches in the United States at hereandnow.org. Stephen, thank you.
My pleasure to be with you.
And when you're there, let us know what your favorite beach is and why. People are already weighing in on our Facebook page. You can do that, too, at facebook.com/hereandnowradio. Magna, your favorite beach?
I do. My favorites are right around Yahats, Oregon. You mentioned the Oregon coastline. Fabulous beaches and wonderful camping.
So two votes for Oregon right there. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.